Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Our producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call it Rethink the Week. When do we tape Monday? We tape it on Friday morning. So Lynn Ekdahl, my political poet, occasionally sends me something that she's writing, and she's always on point, and she's always very timely for the moment that we are living in. And Lynn sent me the following. The chief thief's pickles. The chief thief lacks the dimes and even nickels that he needs to extricate himself from pickles of the legal sort that have him somewhat harried. A richer immigrant he should have married. While he said that he had billions he could beckon, on needing to produce them didn't reckon, and now it seems no one will give him bond, afraid that in the end they will be conned. For years the Don has cheated one and all, yet managed to avoid a fatal fall. Gone bankrupt, yes, failed lots, but blessed, with system slow, not speed obsessed. Now once again for Don the system works, slow rolling all the charges, Kafka's clerks. Postpone the days of reckoning until the chances to convict him become nil. So Donald rolls along his crooked way, perhaps some court will finally make him pay. But if as jailbird chief thief doesn't sing, we may have to deal with Donald as our king. Ooh, Lynn Ekdahl, do I love you. Joining us right now is our fantastic panel of guests. I'm going to start with our normies. Steve Pimper is a professor of public policy at Vermont Law School and Graduate School. He's the author of four books, including A People's History of Poverty, and most recently, Politics for Social Workers, A Practical Guide to Effecting Change. I want to congratulate my alma mater, Vermont Law School, for hiring you, Mr. Pimper. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Arnie, although I'm not sure how I feel about being referred to as a normie.
Oh, shut up. Well, regular. I should have said regular. But then I keep thinking about, you know, eating prunes. So I don't like the word regular. Anyway, Lincoln Mitchell teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. He is the author of eight books, and his writings have appeared at CNN, Reuters, The New York Times, NBC, The San Francisco Examiner, and numerous other media platforms. For more of Lincoln's work, you can subscribe to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Mitchell.
We haven't even been on the air for 5 minutes, and I've been compared to a normie. And what I take you meant as verbal diarrhea. So I can see it's going to be that kind of a show.
It is going to be that kind of a show. That's okay. I didn't sleep last night. And finalmente, she has never joined our Rethink the Week panel, but I'm so glad that she agreed to do this. Amy Littlefield is the abortion access correspondent at The Nation and a freelance investigative reporter who focuses on the intersection of religion and healthcare. Welcome to the program, Amy, and thank you for joining these two gentlemen.
Great to be here with all of you. And Arnie, does that make me an irregular? I'm not sure how I feel about that. A little nervous.
Good. Ba-dong bong. Okay, that was excellent. So I sent everyone out a whole sort of series of possible topics. And then, of course, it's the morning and I start sort of scoping around and looking. And I'm going to start with my political science professor who did the practical guide for effecting change for social workers. Stephen Pimper, this is the 14th anniversary of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, affectionately called Obamacare, that every Republican's tried to kill since it actually was even thought about. I remember being so hopeful with the Affordable Care Act. And the reason I was so hopeful wasn't just that Obama was going to be sort of pushing it forward, but there was this suggestion that there might even be included something called a public option. And of course, one of the first things that fell was the public option, because what did Barack Obama do in an attempt to bring Republicans over to his side is that he negotiated with himself. So instead of negotiating with Republicans, he negotiated with himself and got rid of the public option. But despite that, there have been some very positive things about the Affordable Care Act. So while I'm still a bit angry about the public option, while I'm still a bit angry that it continued to sort of negotiate with pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies, there has been some benefit to the ACA. So as someone who teaches public policy and does this practical guide with social workers, give me your thoughts as we approach this 14th anniversary and where you see the next steps, assuming Donald Trump and the Republicans do not take over.
So to quote Joe Biden, caught on a hot mic during the signing ceremony, the Affordable Care Act was a big effing deal. It failed against the fondest hopes of many, but succeeded where Clinton had failed. And it succeeded in part by learning the lessons of the Clinton administration's failure at healthcare reform. And part of what you're complaining about, right, carving out deals with big pharma, is what bought their silence. So they didn't come out in support of the bill, but they didn't mobilize against it. And the consequence is we've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 plus million people with access to health insurance who wouldn't otherwise have had it. We've now got national law that forbids insurance companies from selling you junk policies, right? Before the ACA, right, you could buy an insurance policy, spend $300, $400, $500 a month, actually get sick, and then have the company either entirely cut you off the policy or not permit you to use it, right? Kids up to the age of 26 can now be insured through their parents' program. We've got radical expansion of the Medicaid program throughout the states, right? Do we still have more uninsured people than any other rich democracy on the planet? Yes. Do we still have a long way to go? Yes. Do we still have higher rates of infant mortality and lower rates of life expectancy than other rich democracies? Yes. But we've got to take the wins where we can and learn the lessons about the limits of policymaking in our deeply undemocratic and broken system.
You know, Amy, that should be a commercial, what Stephen just did. And the reason it should be a commercial is that it recognizes the effort it took to get there. It recognizes the compromises that needed to be made to get us even to the point we're at. But it also recognizes what we still must do, because despite the Affordable Care Act, despite the 20 million, but despite the fact that you can stay on your parents' policy until you're 26, this despite the fact that they got rid of like pre-existing conditions, all those things, we still have a lower life expectancy. It's getting lower every year. We still are not as healthy as other countries. We're still spending sometimes between one third and twice as much. And in a lot of ways, that is the commercial, because what it says is policy works. But that's not the end. It's the beginning of the pathway to where we ultimately need to go. Because you know what? We need to include more people in health insurance. We need to make sure that people don't suffer from, you know, medical bankruptcies. We need to make sure that everyone can still afford what it is they're getting. But I think in a lot of ways, it's almost a teachable moment about what the 2024 election is about. Is that we started, we're not even close to being there, but this is the direction we've taken you. Let us keep taking you even farther from that direction.
Right. And Arnie, let me put on my abortion goggles for a minute here, okay? Because every question I answer has to be within that wheelhouse here. But I mean, I really do think abortion is sort of the canary in the coal mine, with showing us the gaps that exist, not just in, I mean, hello, the fact that we still have the Hyde Amendment, the fact that we still ban, you know, Medicaid coverage of abortion, the fact that that has rendered abortion access, you know, off limits for people in many red states for, you know, almost half a century now. And that was a failing of Obamacare, you know, that was not reversed. But also the state-by-state-by-state approach. I mean, it makes me so furious when I think about the death toll and the sickness toll from the fact that Republican states chose not to expand Medicaid after the Affordable Care Act just because they wanted to, you know, flip the bird to the Obama administration and score political points. And that's why I have this like reflexive anger, you know, about the Affordable Care Act. But these issues are all connected. And you know, I think if there abortion is a canary in the coal mine, like I said, for highlighting the problems, highlighting the gaps. But I also think we're seeing some really exciting innovation in that space right now. Organizations like Aid Access that have doctors in states like Massachusetts, New York, Colorado, who are now shipping abortion-inducing medications to red states, and they're doing it very inexpensively. They're doing it for free for people who can't afford it. They're shifting the legal risk away from, you know, patients in states like Texas and on to clinicians in blue states that will protect them. And they're finding a way to do it that's outside the box, right? And some of the folks involved in the system are advocates of single payer who are saying, look, we've made some assumptions about healthcare delivery here, and this is a catastrophe, which is awful to witness, but also an opportunity to rethink the system.
Absolutely. And again, I want to, as I'm thinking about rethinking the system, one of those states that did not expand Medicaid was Texas. Texas has the highest number of uninsured in the United States, okay? Texas is the place where they have that six-week abortion ban. Texas is the place where they deputize people so that they could basically finger anyone that aids or abets someone who's getting an abortion, and that could mean driving them to an airport. That's why the story you're telling about the doctors that are sending this medication are being protected by their states, because they must be protected by their states because of what is that overreach by Texas. So again, these stories are so important. But Lincoln, I, before we leave the Affordable Care Act, and we're all bringing in an interesting piece, I do need to share something with you, because this really does speak to one of the provisions in the Affordable Care Act that, believe it or not, I was somewhat personally involved in. And that is expanding or protecting young people so that they can stay on their parents' plan to the age of 26. And what you don't know, and I'll send all of you this story, but back in 2003, a mother had a daughter who was at Plymouth State College. The daughter was under her parents' health insurance plan. The daughter was diagnosed with cancer. The doctor said the daughter needed to leave school in order to be treated for her stage 4 cancer. But guess what? No sooner did the daughter leave school than she was no longer covered by the mother's health insurance plan. So they had to make a Sophie's choice. Do I keep my kid in school in order to stay insured, or do I take her out to be treated for her cancer? Think about this. Think about this. It's immoral. You buy insurance to cover your kid for getting sick, but the only way your kid could actually be covered is if they're in school, because if they're almost dying of cancer, then they have to leave school, then they're not covered. And it ended up that we managed to shame the New Hampshire legislature and get Governor Lynch to sign a bill that became what's known as Michelle's Law. And Michelle's Law basically forced insurance companies in New Hampshire to cover young people for at least a year after they left school on their parents' insurance plan. Then they took Michelle's Law, and George Bush actually signed a bill that would expand healthcare for people under the age of 26. And now we see this is one of the most important provisions in the ACA, is that parents actually can keep their kids on their insurance plan, whether they're employed, whether they're in school, till the age of 26. And that has made such a huge difference for young people who, frankly, you know, are in the beginning stages of maybe a job or whatever, and can't necessarily find an insurance plan that's affordable. But isn't it amazing? It started in 2003. With this mother who comes and begs the New Hampshire legislature, don't ask parents to make this choice. This is immoral, Lincoln. So again, I want people to know your stories are important, because they ultimately can change the consequence of policy and history. But we're only at, I think, the halfway point, not even close to that, when it comes to healthcare, Lincoln.
So much about the healthcare discourse is immoral. You know, when you give this story, and I have two sons in their 20s, so I'm acutely aware of how important this is. But as my older son approaches his 25th birthday, the question that comes to my mind is, what happens when he turns 27? At that point, magically, he's supposed to have a full-time job with healthcare. And how could we possibly be making this assumption that your basic healthcare needs can only be met if you have a full-time job, or if you're over a certain age or under a certain age and have parents who have a full-time job? You know, Joe Biden's technical assessment that Stephen cited about the Affordable Care Act is indeed true, but that speaks to just how dire the situation was before the Affordable Care Act. And we now have many people who don't remember that, because it was getting to be a while ago, and people tend to remember things exactly how they want to based on their own partisan lean. So they say, well, look how bad the Affordable Care Act is, because the healthcare system is still so terrible. And this is what I just keep what I find so frustrating here. Barack Obama succeeded where every Democratic president since Harry Truman had failed, which was to create some kind of a healthcare program. And that's what he got, was some kind of a healthcare program, but it wasn't enough. And at the time, and you are where you started your show, was extremely important here. He negotiated himself down.
Yes, right? He did.
And at the time, what we heard from many of the supporters of Obama, of which I was one, but I didn't say this because I knew it couldn't possibly be true, is don't worry, we'll get this passed and then we'll improve it, which happens, well, actually never with regards to public policy. What happens is you get it and then the powerful moneyed interests chip away at it. That's the more usual path, and that's what we're seeing here. And, you know, I wonder, because you said assuming, you know, if the Republicans get a trifecta, you know, they tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act last time. Famously, John McCain cast the deciding vote against repealing, in other words, in favor of keeping it. And in doing that, he may have saved the Republican Party. Yeah. The idea of just stripping this basic healthcare program away from people is a terrible idea that's wildly unpopular. It's not the Republican Party that should be charged with finding something better, because they're not interested in governance. And their official position seems to be, who cares that the American people get sick and die, right? It should be on the Democratic Party to get something better, to move in a more Medicare for all direction over time. That's where this has to lead, because it is fantastic that you get coverage, get your kid covered. If you have a job with insurance until they're 26 and then turn 27, like, sorry, don't get sick.
Amy, I have a question. When I was first hired in 1976 by this small little tiny law firm in the Twin Cities, and they were just organizing. And so they brought in the person who was going to be offering us our health insurance plan. So it was the lawyer, it was me, the paralegal, it was two of the secretaries. There was about eight of us in the room. Now I'm the youngest in the room. And it was 1976. I remember the date. And I remember sitting there, and as we were talking about what was in our plan, I raised my hand and I said, will you cover me for an abortion? Everyone in the room went like this. They looked at me like, excuse me? But you know what was interesting? The guy who was selling us the insurance said, I have no clue. And I guess I'm going to ask the question, Amy. Are abortions covered by insurance companies? Do you have to ask for it? Is it a rider? Could it be prevented by states? I'm kind of curious about that. I go back to 1976, but you know, it's been a long time since I've asked that question. But I'm curious about whether health insurance actually sees this as something that is a requirement for coverage.
I'm glad it was an abortion question, Arnie. I thought you were going to ask me about how I am a success story because I got to stay on my parents' health insurance until I was 26.
Oh, no, no, no.
And now I'm on my husband's. So freelance journalism for life. So that's, you know, and I love that this was 1976, Arnie, because that is the critical year. That is the critical year. That's the year the Hyde Amendment passed in Congress. That's the year that Democrats like Joe Biden supported the ban on federal funding of abortion. That meant that Medicaid patients in most states were going to have to find hundreds of dollars to pay for it out of pocket or stay pregnant, or like Rosie Jimenez did in Texas, seek an unsafe abortion and die as a result. Okay. 1976 was the turning point. I'm obsessed with the Hyde Amendment because to me, it's like we put a moral, the religious right, which was, you know, just sort of getting off the ground at that point, put this moral gloss on what was just an Ebenezer Scrooge moment, which was taking away necessary health care from poor people. Okay, that's what it was. And that was the foundation. And to answer your question, I mean, now it depends on your health insurance plan, and it depends more than anything on where you live, because there are states that have restricted not just Medicaid funding of abortion, of course, but also private insurance coverage, also what's available on the state-based exchange through Obamacare, what you can and can't purchase. There's all sorts of loopholes and elaborate ways of getting, right? I mean, there's religious healthcare plans, right? There's Catholic hospitals and Catholic healthcare plans in the mix that will outsource and refuse to cover that. And that was a whole another level of, you know, issues that came up related to Obamacare, of course, was, you know, religious objections to contraception coverage, to abortion coverage, which, by the way, abortion was never going to be covered under Obamacare. It depends. I mean, if you have a private insurance plan that covers it, if you have an employer that supports it.
I just want people to start asking. I go back to 76 and I remember him saying, I have no clue. I have no clue. And everyone in the room is like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. But I go back to where we are today and it becomes an actually critical question as we approach this. So, Stephen, we've been talking a lot about the health care. We've been talking a lot about the Affordable Care Act. We've been talking a lot about abortion. I want to go to Medicare, because there is a war on Medicare, and I don't know whether you had a chance to read it, but at Healthcare Uncovered, which is a fabulous subsect that looks at the whole issue of healthcare, one of the things that I'm apoplectic about is Medicare Advantage, because I think Medicare Advantage is really the backdoor way of really gutting Medicare for All, and Medicare, period, not just Medicare for All, the 65, you know, you get Medicare kind of concept. And the reason I'm now convinced more than ever that Medicare Advantage is the camel's nose under the tent to get rid of this concept of public Medicare is that it turns out that it's actually included in Project 2025. And Project 2025, Stephen, as you know, is the Heritage Foundation plan about how they're going to gut democracy, how they're going to gut healthcare, how they're going to just do all these incredibly destructive things. And it turns out that one of the things that they're asking for in Project 2025 is that when people then qualify for Medicare at age 65, instead of automatically having them go into the Medicare plan, they're automatically enrolled in the private Medicare Advantage plans. All right. And then in order for them to get back on traditional Medicare, they have to opt out. Well, we're already seeing so many Americans going into Medicare Advantage without any really understanding of why it's a disadvantage and not an advantage, why insurance companies are now making more money on Medicare Advantage than any of their other plans that they offer, which obviously means if they're making more money, you're probably getting less healthcare. But look that it is in Project 2025. And what is the agenda? That you are automatically enrolled in Medicare Advantage and not Medicare. And you know, the only reason they would actually even suggest that is that this is their backdoor way of completely privatizing Medicare.
So we spend more per person on healthcare than any other rich democracy on the planet. And as we've already referred to, we get worse results for it,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So if we were spending more than everybody else and getting terrific outcomes, maybe that would make sense, right? We don't. Why don't we? Because unlike almost every other system, we've got a great big giant profit-seeking enterprise sitting between each of us and our healthcare. Yes. And that profit-seeking enterprise is not interested in our health or in our well-being. It is interested in extracting resources from us and making themselves wealthier.
Right.
We'll just quickly touch back on something that Amy observed that struck me, because, you know, she said that the answer ultimately the question is, well, it depends, right? It depends on all kinds of things. It depends on where you live, right? That right now seems to me the description of well-being in the United States across every dimension.
Right.
We have got such a deeply dysfunctional and fractured system that the answer to almost every question is, well, it depends. Where do you live, right? What kind of access do you have? How much money do you have? What are your neighborhoods like? What are your schools like? What are the hospitals like, right? What is access to transportation like? What is the real estate market like, right? There is no nation in that regard anymore. We've got this collection of fiefdoms. And I think this matters for a whole host of reasons, but I think it also is what makes it easier for authoritarians to come to power, both because they can point to the dysfunction and the chaos and present themselves as a solution, but also count on those divisions interfering with our ability to behave among each other in solidaristic fashion.
So Lincoln, we only have 2 minutes left, but I'm going to give you more time after the break. But as I'm listening to Stephen, I go back to, I'm working with this friend of mine who's dying, who's trying to raise the free lunches in New Hampshire, the seventh richest state in the nation, by the way, from 135% of the poverty level to 350% of the poverty level. So he wants to provide kids and families with access to a free lunch. And as I'm listening to Stephen talking about the division and the chaos, and it depends on where you live, I want to just share with you something that's fascinating. New Hampshire is the seventh richest state in the nation. We are surrounded by three states, the state of Vermont, the state of Maine, and the state of Massachusetts. What do I know about Maine, Vermont, and Massachusetts? They all provide every child with a free lunch. You don't need to qualify. You just need to show up in school, okay? That's all you need. And here's the kicker. Maine and Vermont are significantly poorer than New Hampshire. We are freaking rich. And yet we are at 135% of the poverty level. And when we talk about the chaos that we're hearing with Stephen, how come we can't point to the states that invest in their families, the state that invests in their children, are all blue states? The states that leave you on your own, Jack, are all red states. And if the Republicans win, join the red world, you're screwed. I mean, instead of talking about it as a division, talk about it as an opportunity to lift those up as opposed to feed into the chaos. Lincoln.
Let me try to answer your question. With as my normal upbeat, optimistic approach, which is that, you know, a lot of people are okay with that, right? Live free or die. a lot of people in red states believe that people should get have a fantasy about how government works and how individuals work. And they believe that a lunch, even to a five-year-old, is a handout. And a handout is, you know, half a step away from the Stalinist gulag.
And on that note, we need to go to a break, and then I'm going to go, but have you continue with the gulag. We're talking with Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University, Stephen Pimpare, professor of public policy at Vermont Law School, and Amy Littlefield, the abortion access correspondent at The Nation. This, everyone, is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We call it Rethink the Week, and we will be right back.
Are frozen embryos children? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The recent Alabama case involved embryos created in vitro and accidentally destroyed at the fertility clinic where they were being preserved. There, as is typical in vitro fertilization, an egg and a sperm were joined in a lab to create an embryo that can be stored for decades. The adult sued under the state's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, and the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that the fact that the embryos had existed only in a lab and had never been implanted in a uterus was irrelevant. They said that the laboratory embryos were children, unborn children, regardless of their, in the court's words, location. The rationale? Life begins at fertilization. Those fertilized eggs in the lab were children, unborn children, in the Chief Justice's words, little people. In response to the in vitro decision, the Alabama legislature passed a law that protects IVF clinics from lawsuits. But the Alabama case and its rationale remain. Under Dobbs, that's the Supreme Court case that reversed Roe v. Wade, women no longer have the right to make their own reproductive choices. That decision is now up to the government. So, what used to be a woman's right to choose is now a matter of legislative roulette. And as the croupier says at the table, round and round she goes. Where she stops, nobody knows. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people, this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now. And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept, locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott, Stephanie Collins. We're continuing to record on Friday morning. We also call this our Rethink the Week. We're rejoined by Amy Littlefield, who is an abortion access correspondent at The Nation, Stephen Pimpare, professor of public policy at Vermont Law School, and Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. So I cut you off at the end of the first half hour, Lincoln, and we got to the gulag. But there was a statement that you made that got me very upset. And then during the break, Stephen Pimpare said, no, Lincoln's absolutely right. Lincoln's absolutely right. And Lincoln, remind my audience what you suggested to me about this idea of, I said, we should just micro-target, let everyone everyone know in all those red states that you will benefit from this free lunch. You will benefit from this expanded Medicaid. You will benefit from this, I don't know, whatever the program is, this job opportunity, whatever it is. And just say, this is about you and your family. If you vote in a different way from Donald Trump, we're not promising you nirvana, but what we can assure you is that things will be markedly better because we can point to these programs that you and your family and your community will benefit from. And then Stephen and you, Lincoln, said that won't motivate them if they think a poor person or a person of color will also get it. How the hell is that possible?
I was very specific. This is about race. Yeah. If you say a white person, you know, this isn't just a free lunch program, just to go back to the school lunch. This is a program for your child. But if they think their child is getting a lunch and an African-American child down the road is getting a lunch, they'd rather have two starving children. And that is what has driven the racism that has underpinned so much of public policy in the United States going back over half a century now. And that's really the horror, one of the horrors of American racism. But it cannot be overlooked. And as much as I would like to agree, I just don't see this. I mean, I support the policy, of course, but I don't see this as some kind of a deus ex machina that's going to save Democratic messaging. This is the kind of thing that the Democrats have been trying to say with varying degrees of articulateness, pardon my inarticulateness, for decades. And yeah, what we see, you know, over and over again is that there is a huge constituency that on the one hand believes that anything, any government program, particularly one that doesn't benefit them directly, and for middle-class people, the programs that benefit them directly are things like being able to write off the interest on your mortgage, the 529 college savings program, Social Security, if you're employed, you know, at a high salary. Those are programs that in many respects shift wealth upward. And those are Republicans, those are programs Republicans love. But Americans there is a deep antipathy towards progressive programs. And of course, race underlies that to a great extent, but we can't just say we're going to just present it differently and get different results. There's not a shred of data that suggests that.
Oh, God. So a lot of the stories that are coming out of Texas, unfortunately, Stephen Pimper. And they're stories that really, I think, are so horrific. We talked a little bit about the abortion story and the deputizing of individuals who, you know, basically can harass anyone that they think has any connection to a woman or a family member seeking an abortion. But there is another story that's also coming out of Texas, and it deals with the whole immigration issue. It's flipping the bird at the concept of preemption and the federal government having oversight over immigration policy. And Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern at Slate.com wrote a fabulous piece. It was entitled, "The Supreme Court Just Gave Texas a Green Light to Harass Every Latino Person in the State." And that is because in a 6-3 decision along the usual lines on Tuesday, this is of last week, the Supreme Court allowed Texas Senate Bill 4, which is a usurpation of federal immigration law, to take effect. Through this divided and unreasoned vote, the High Court will allow Texas to seize enforcement of immigration powers away from the federal government, a direct violation of a 2012 Supreme Court decision, which was known as "Show Me Your Papers." In so doing, the conservative majority has blessed galling chicanery by the Court of Appeals, which sought to shield Texas's law from Supreme Court review. Ultimately, what it now means is that this, it's basically, it is the Show Me Your Papers bill. They can stop anyone because they are now going to be allowed to enforce immigration policy that they've never been allowed to do. And they're going to basically not only be able to stop people, arrest people, but then take them to Texas judges and have them sent back to wherever they came from. This is terrifying that Texas would do this. But what is so remarkable is just within days of Texas passing this law and of what's happening at the Supreme Court, we're seeing a lot of MAGA governors around the country doing exactly the same thing. I believe it just passed in at least one house in Iowa. I'm waiting for the crazies in New Hampshire to do the same thing. But this is terrifying because it's not even about immigration. It is not about undocumented workers. It's about a suspicion that you don't belong here. And who we think doesn't belong here usually is brown, swarthy, slanted eyes, a Latino accent, and that becomes the reason to stop them. This is an unbelievable decision, both by the courts, but what we see in Texas doesn't stay in Texas.
So I think it's worth noting, as of Friday morning, the Fifth Circuit in Texas has reimposed a stay on the law, so it is not currently in effect. But it's been bouncing back and forth and back and forth.
Okay, I'm a yo-yo.
The larger point, and the one that concerns me more, and you've heard me complain about in the past, is the inconsistency and the lawlessness of the courts themselves, right? It is interesting to me to see when it is that they will defer to states and when it is that they will not, right? So we had a decision, 3 weeks ago now, that we could not permit the state of Colorado to disqualify Donald Trump from the ballot, despite clear evidence and a judiciary finding that he had committed insurrection, because it would create inconsistency across the states and would sow chaos. However, when it comes to immigration policy, somehow it's okay that we can leave that up to the states. Right now, it's not just merely the inconsistency here is when states have power, when states don't. But of course, the political, the partisan political valence of this, right, is impossible, it seems to me, to ignore. And once again, this is me suggesting we need to think of courts as political institutions like any other, and not assume that just because they are engaged, they're dressed in robes and are engaged in arcane rhetorical gestures, that somehow they have more insight into what is good, right, proper, legal, and constitutional than any other citizen or political actor. They are lawless. They are pursuing their own narrow goals. And sooner or later, we need other political institutions to stand up and say, no, we will ignore these decisions. They are unlawful and they are wrong.
So, Amy, I've spoken on many occasions during doing graduation speeches, for example, where I talk about that what may be legal may not be just. What may be legal may not be just. And you and I both know that we're looking at the Dobbs decision. Well, the Dobbs decision was a legal decision by the Supreme Court. It was their interpretation of the Constitution and it rolled back to right. While that may have been their interpretation of legality, you and I both know it screams injustice. It screams injustice. And as I'm listening to Stephen Pimper talking, I'm just trying to figure out, has Stephen just defended what Governor Abbott is attempting to do, which is flip the bird at preemption, because he now had cover, at least for a short period of time, apparently the Fifth Circuit has now taken away that cover, basically by the Supreme Court, that he could then be responsible for what has historically been the province of the federal government and not the state government. And you don't want 50 states with 50 different versions of immigration policy. We can't handle that. Nobody can handle that. And so what I'm trying to figure out is, Stephen is right. They are political animals. They put on a black robe, but it doesn't change what happens, especially when you look at the kind of appointments that were being made by Donald Trump, which basically came out of the Federalist Society and Letter Leo, and they knew exactly what they were planting. But then I'm just trying to figure out, so what do we do with the chaos? Where do we go to create something in the way of stability if I can't trust a court? If the legislature has been gerrymandered, if there's too much money in politics and the lobbyists and the checks they write to buy and sell politicians makes it problematic. And then I look at this new article that just came out about the Republicans and who they've chosen to run for the U.S. Senate. Most of what the Republicans have chosen are not only conservatives, maybe in the ilk of Donald Trump, but you know what they're capable of doing? Self-funding. They're multimillionaires. So I'm looking at a situation where it's all chaos, and I'm not sure where I go to find a path or a GPS to what will ultimately get me to something in the way of stability and what I believe is justice, because everything I look at seems to be rotting out.
And I mean, Arnie, I have to say, to Stephen's point, like any mention of the Fifth Circuit for me as an abortion reporter is very triggering and upsetting. Okay, because anyone who's been watching this space on reproductive rights knows that the courts are rigged. We were watching in terror as Donald Trump made federal court appointment after federal court appointment, and understanding that courts are just as partisan, if not more so, than the rest of our rotten political landscape. But I think Lincoln's point about, you know, about race is really key here, because where did the states' rights rallying cry start, right? Where did states' rights, where did that come from? Why does that sound familiar? Okay, it was about slavery. It was about, you know, right. States. And I'm not the only one who has made the comparison, right, between slave states and free states and what we're seeing now and how that map transposes so vividly with what we're seeing now in terms of not just abortion rights, but a whole range of, you know, access to the basic necessities that people need to thrive and survive, right? And the same states that are restricting access to healthcare and to basic necessities and to the social safety net are the ones that have banned abortion. And that maps, you know, very closely with our state's history. And so it is, race is central here. And as is Stephen's point about, hey, we're a whole, you know, this is a bunch of fiefdoms, and that's an unjust system. I mean, where do we go from here, Arnie? I think it's a really important question when these states are so gerrymandered, when people who are rising up and, you know, demanding change in red states, and there are many people doing that, you know, face all of these challenges. I think one answer is we're seeing these ballot initiatives. We're seeing expression after expression of growing public outrage and consensus around the fact that our system is broken. I'm watching the ballot initiatives on abortion rights in particular very closely. But we've also seen, you know, success around ballot measures for raising the minimum wage, you know, even in red states. So that's one glimmer, I think, of creative thinking, of hope in our very
But I also want
picture.
To remind you that one of the states that have used referendum very effectively has been the state of California. And sometimes we think that they're grassroots actions, but sometimes they're astroturf. Because you find out that, you know, who can also use a referendum are very deep pockets with a very, very different agenda. And what
look how the billionaires are trying to buy San Francisco with right-wing initiatives.
That's my point.
That's a perfect example of that. Right.
Let me just say something. The race card that you were talking about, Lincoln, the race card is behind almost every noxious thing we think about. Abortion, healthcare, feeding people, whatever. But let me share one more thing that the race card is involved in. And that is the concept of school vouchers and the attack on public education. The attack on public education isn't because public schools are doing bad. It's that they want to use public dollars, what? For this thing called private choice, which is about vouchers. And vouchers really is about resegregating society and using these public dollars to send kids to parochial schools and private schools and homeschools. But Lincoln, let me just share something that just came out last week. So we have a voucher program in New Hampshire. The guy that basically initiated the voucher program is Betsy DeVos and Pants in my state. He's a multimillionaire, homeschooler, never touched education until he became the commissioner of education. And his entire agenda is to dismantle public education. So we have something called vouchers, but they're not called vouchers. They're called education freedom accounts. That means these education freedom accounts, Lincoln, are what? They are actually sent to a private contractor. So we're sort of laundering these public dollars through these private contractors. And they take these education freedom accounts, and then they divide the money up where the parents want those dollars to go, to whatever the private institution is or the religious institution. Well, in 2022, we suddenly realized, my God, look at all this money that's public dollars that are going into vouchers. What are they doing with this voucher money? So we demanded an audit of the dollars going into the education freedom accounts. Do you know why they can't audit them? Because the dollars are being washed and rinsed through a private contractor, not a state organized facility. And because it is a private contractor, the private contractor does not have to comply with the audit. Oh my God. Not only is this about race and resegregating, but look what they get to do. They get to grab all the public dollars and you can't even track them because they ran them through a private operation. This is disgusting.
and that contractor, and I'm going way out on a limb here, maybe has some relations or has made some campaign contributions to some of these legislators because they are collecting the interest on that money while it sits there. So the corruption is always there and the avarice is always there. I want to just take – I'm not comfortable with the term race card here. What we're talking about here is racism, and we should call it what it is. Racism is always at the center. Racism is always driving this, and you are absolutely right about what is called euphemistically the school choice movement. And I would just maybe flesh that out a little bit. In the South, this grows out of post-Brown v. Board America, where the Supreme Court says you have to segregate or integrate now previously segregated public schools. There was a big fight over that for those of you who've never learned anything about American history. And what happens once there's some success is that these private schools emerge, generally Christian in nature, read white, for white kids. So now that we have the parents are paying money because they don't want to have their kids go, the white parents, with African-American students, we have to somehow give them money because God forbid they should have to pay for their racism out of their own pocket. So now we create these voucher programs and these school choice programs, as they're euphemistically known. I want to give a couple of other examples of this. Another is the CUNY system, the city here in New York City, where free tuition went away when the system student body became substantially non-white. So what had been a free program for generations, and it's and let's be serious, be real here. This is the City College of New York is an extraordinary school with an extraordinary record of creating a middle class, was free when it was overwhelmingly white. Paid free tuition goes away in the 1960s as it becomes majority, or not majority, but substantially non-white, and then majority non-white. Another piece of this is the labor unions. Teachers unions who have been attacked over and over and over again by Republicans and the right are substantially probably majority female. So there's a gender component of this, right? And also disproportionately non-white in many cities. So, you know, it doesn't sound like a particularly profound observation to say that racism is absolutely at the center of conservative American politics and always has been, but it is worth connecting the dots every now and then because it's important to understand that when we talk about systemic racism, institutional racism, these aren't just buzzwords. These aren't just things we say after some horrible killing of a young African-American person by a white police officer. It's that, and it's something much deeper, which permeates all of our policymaking and is deeply tied. If you follow the money, you will find that it often leads you to the racism.
It does. It does. Oh, my God. So we only have a few minutes left, and I want to sort of end with this. So the Economic Policy Institute and Oxfam and a couple of people are looking at sort of the grotesque inequality, especially in America. This came out of Oxfam. The largest 200 U.S. public companies are more profitable than ever, but shareholders are hoarding the vast majority of corporate earnings. Their net profits soared to $1.25 trillion in 2022, a 63% increase since 2018. And this is the kicker language. A whopping 90% of that was paid out to shareholders. $448 billion came in the form of dividends, while the rest was a record $681 billion were then in the form of stock buybacks. Now, Stephen, I know there, you know, most of us or 80% of us may have some kind of dabbling in the stock market, although 90% of the stock market is owned by 10% of Americans. So we may have a couple of shares, but we're clearly not benefiting from those profits we were just describing. But you know who wasn't benefiting, Stephen? The workers who delivered the profits. And I think this nugget alone is worth the price of admission in 2024. Not only did many of these corporations not pay taxes, not only did many of these corporations see that their five top senior management were paid more than they actually paid the federal government in the taxes on their billions of dollars of profit, but then you see who benefits from the profit? 90% went to stockholders. How do you not scream that from the top of the mountain? And how do you not make people understand you delivered the profit and you saw nothing?
It's worth pointing out that this is not a natural occurrence, right? This is a product of public policy, right? We have created the world that we are living in many respects. We earlier were talking about sort of the ways in which we might learn some lessons, particularly around healthcare, from looking at other nations. But we can also look at our own history for lessons about how to work toward a more just and equitable distribution of resources. If you look at the immediate period after World War II, we had the highest levels of overall growth we have seen in our history. And if you look at how that's distributed across income portions, right, it was distributed pretty equally, with actually the bottom 20% doing a little bit better than every other group. This goes through, depending on how you slice the salami, 1973-1979, right? Suddenly, we move to a world in which overall growth is lower, and that's a whole separate question maybe, but that distribution now is flipped. And the higher you are on the income scale, the more you benefit from that economic growth. That is a consequence of explicit changes in tax policy, tying all of the things that we've been talking about, people with money using the opportunities in the U.S. political system to get advantage in order to enact policies that benefit them rather than the population at large.
Amy, we're going to end with you. So you are a freelance investigator who focuses on the intersection of religion and healthcare. And I posted something on Facebook the other day because I was just apoplectic. And it was a story coming out of France, all right? And I was looking at the, and the French are, they're consistently always unhappy, okay? But when I look at what they have in the way of investments in their families, and then I look at this country, I get crazy. And here's what I wrote. I wrote, does America hate families? In France, they have housing supplements, family allowances for more than two children, free preschool for all, excellent free national health care, and now a constitutional protection for abortion. I said, a rich country that doesn't set families up to fail. But here is the US. We are a rich country that has perfected the art of basically failing families. And I do think, and the idea that they included abortion in their constitution is why I sort of turned to you at this very end, Amy, because they understood that abortion was really a consequence of democracy, that it was part of this whole idea, if you're going to embrace democracy, then you must embrace this. And they connected the dots. But look what they're doing for families across the board. And look what we are doing. We're undermining them across the board.
Absolutely, Arnie. And I mean, what France has done is lay the groundwork for actual choice, right? Yes. For people to make a meaningful decision about whether to have a child when they have access to social supports, when they have access to the things that we actually need to parent. And within the United States, you know, what we have is a system that is so constrained, where people are making these decisions under so much duress, the fear of criminalization if they live in a red state, the inability to access basic resources to even make a meaningful decision. And that's before you get to the last step, right? Which is, do I have an abortion or do I not? And is that abortion, you know, a 12-hour drive away, or is it something that I can actually access? And Arnie, I just want to say something else to Stephen's point here on business booming and corporate profits, which is, I try not to let any conversation go by without talking about Gaza and the ongoing horror there. And the fact that U.S. corporations are profiting off of, you know, these horrific deaths of women and children and civilians in Palestine.
And it's interesting, I apologize for not getting there, but just this morning, I sent a contribution to feed folks in Gaza. And one of the things I said at the top of what I wrote was, I wrote, starvation should never be a weapon of war. Israel, your war is with Hamas, not the starving residents of Gaza. And let's not forget, President Bush forced an election on the Palestinians in 2006. Fatah was unprepared. And to the shock of the world, Hamas won. And there hasn't been an election since 2006.
Starvation, so starvation is always a weapon of war. And I hope that we're also supporting people who are starving because of other wars. Israel is not the only country killing civilians.
You're absolutely right. And on that note, this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, number two, Dave Scott, Stephanie Collins. We also call it Rethink the Week. Let me thank Amy Littlefield, Stephen Pimpare, and Lincoln Mitchell for joining us. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think. Let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back. Let's go way on, way back when. I didn't even know you. You couldn't have been too much more than 10.